On this week's 51%, hear about hidden voices in storytelling.
What I want people to walk away feeling is that our humanity is inextricable from each other.
How doctors are being trained to work with refugees, and it is tea time practically all the time for a woman who wants to help other women and the planet. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. There are stories, and then there are stories, the kind that stick with you because they are bare and true, and because they make the world look a little different than before. Lyndon Harris is founder and director of Hidden Voices, a nonprofit in Cedar Grove, North Carolina, and these are the kinds of stories in front of her.
I just felt like my whole world had ended. I felt like I wanted to give up. Because I love my children so much, it just tore me up. I couldn't work for a while. It was hard. It was really hard. It was so bad, I had to go see a psychologist while the trial was going on. I did a lot of praying, a lot of praying. Lord, help me get through it, because I was really depressed. Oh, I grew up in the South. Storytelling is what you do. I remember that they were all, this was at my grandmother's house, everybody's sitting around this big table and kick their shoes off. So it's all these women with their bare feet, and they just started to tell stories. And all of a sudden, I heard what they were saying. Like for the first time as a kid, it wasn't just that Charlie Brown kind of wah, 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 you know, people talking. I heard the stories, and I stopped and I stayed in that room and I listened to these women talk, and I thought, this was a hidden world to me that I didn't know existed, and I just wanted to always be a part of it. My name is Lyndon Harris, and I'm the founder and director of Hidden Voices. Hidden Voices is an organization that works with marginalized and underrepresented communities to help them share their stories in public forums to create change. The day of the trial, we thought he was coming home because they didn't have no kind of evidence. My son called on my lunch break and said, "Mama, I'll be home tonight." So that was a real big shock when they came back with that verdict. Most of the jury weren't educated, a lot weren't listening. You could see one juror was asleep. The trial was only one day. Everybody knew it wasn't fair, but I couldn't afford to buy another lawyer. One of the projects we did was called Speaking Without Tongues, and it was with survivors of family violence. It was a group of six women, and they were just wired, terrified, shaking beforehand. And when they came off after that first performance, one of the women looked at me and said, "I don't remember ever feeling this light." And some of the audience members said, "I just feel so heavy." And I said, "That's beautiful, because we're sharing the burden that we carry. We're spreading it around." I tell my son now, "You know, if they would let me go back there and stay with you in prison, I would." And he says, "Mama, I know you would." Every time he calls and speaks of something down the road, I always say, "Well, I'm hoping you're going to be home by then. I'm hoping you're going to be home." It feels time critical. I mean, we're talking about people who've been sentenced to be killed. Some of the family members that we've worked with have lost someone. you know, they were executed last year. So one of the things we do with every project is we create what we call a cycle of monologues. So we take stories people have been sharing and we create these short first-person pieces. And this is Count, Stories from America's Death Row. And this is a mother speaking. I pray that I'll still be here when he gets home. I say, Lord, I know you're going to bring him. You're going to bring him sometime, but please let me be alive so we can have some time together. I suppose what I want people to walk away feeling is that our humanity is inextricable from each other. That we are connected in the most profound ways, which means we are responsible for each other. It's not something to hide from or be afraid of, it's something to embrace. He says, Mama, all I want out of life is to be able to take care of you because you deserve it. You work so hard and no matter what your boy's ever done, you never judged us. And I tell him, well, I ain't liked you sometimes, but I always loved you. I sure would like to be able to touch my son, just hug him. It's been so long.
Through a dynamic use of call and response, It's Been So Long unearths the powerful ways that one woman uses storytelling to connect us all. This story was produced by LaRonda Manigo Bryant and Kim Naderfane Petersa, alumni of Duke University Center for Documentary Studies in Durham, North Carolina. Across the United States, there's a push to give new doctors special training to work with refugees and other immigrants. And some say it's the difference between healthy and sick patients. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett reports.
On this block on Indianapolis's south side, there's not one, but three international grocery stores here. There's Soraga International Grocery, Tienda Morelos, and Chin Asian Grocery. A newspaper clipping from 1965 says a half century ago, this area was almost all white and hostile to minorities. Now a community of Burmese refugees, along with a growing subset of Congolese and Syrian refugees, call this Southside suburb home. And several miles down the road is the Franciscan Health Family Medicine Center.
So we have our kind of underserved Southside population, and then we also have a significant amount of immigrants and refugees.
That's Adam Parlberg, a family medicine doctor at the center. He trains medical residents who help staff this clinic. On this day, around 24 of these residents are watching a MARTI demonstration. That's M-A-R-T-T-I, a system that connects doctors with live interpreters for over 250 languages. It looks like an iPad on a rolling stand. At the front of the room, Parlberg and a medical assistant are staging an exam as part of the training session. The MARTI interpreter will translate his words.
If she has any like headaches or dyspnea or right quadrant pain, edema, vision changes, bleeding, cramping, contractions, abdominal pain, that sort of stuff, probably needs to come to the triage, but we'll see her next week. All right, thank you.
The residents are laughing because Parlberg demonstrated some of the don'ts of working with an interpreter. He asked long, rambling questions and used confusing medical jargon.
As you can imagine, if you tell the patient to break a leg or, you know, this is going to cost you an arm and a leg, you know, there might not be an equivalent there and it can be taken very differently. And
second-year resident Michael Padilla says the demonstration made him more aware of the complexity of translations.
Like, one of the things that we learned that was really cool today is there's no word for anxiety, so they have to describe that. Yeah, and just how some things can get translated, like how you got here turned into how did you make this appointment.
But this training is about cultural considerations too, like knowing to address mental illness, which can be taboo in some cultures. Parlberg says patients sometimes complain of physical symptoms.
They may come in with a headache or abdominal pain or dizziness or something like that.
This means mental illness can go undiagnosed unless a doctor understands cultural clues. Perlberg says training residents to be aware of these considerations isn't just about niceties.
The patient doesn't feel like that you're being mindful or understanding or culturally sensitive. I mean, you've already lost that person. That person's not going to follow your instructions. They're not going to be compliant with the medical care and follow-up and that sort of thing.
And more medical schools are offering this type of training. Here's David Acosta with the Association of American Medical Colleges.
This new generation has a large interest, in getting these experiences. And so medical schools basically are really pushing hard to try to provide those experiences to them.
Of the medical schools the association surveys, more than 60% now offer training on cultural competency. This is up from just 30% several years ago. Perlberg says preparing future doctors to work with people from different cultures isn't just for big cities anymore. Even rural hospitals need it. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
A new report says more than one-third of women in four low-income countries in Africa and Asia were slapped, mocked, forcibly treated, or otherwise abused during childbirth in health centers. The study, published October 9th in the Lancet Medical Journal, says women in Nigeria, Myanmar, Ghana, and Guinea also experienced high rates of cesarean sections and surgical cuts to the vagina without their consent. The study, led by the World Health Organization, followed more than 2,000 women during labor and interviewed more than 2,600 women after childbirth. Some 42% reported physical or verbal abuse or discrimination during childbirth. The study says younger, less educated women are at risk of mistreatment, including neglect or the use of force during procedures. Some women were detained afterward for not being able to pay the bill. Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Sarah Scarborough, who has devoted the past 20 years to uncovering the history and culture of tea. Scarborough has traveled the world to learn the ancient tradition of the tea ceremony and to source ethically grown varieties. She created Fire Pot Nomadic Teas with a mission to improve lives and to give back a percentage of sales to support women in education and for the sustainability of the planet. And she recently launched a partnership with Aquila, an all-women's university in Rwanda, an area where Scarborough also sources tea. Ufberg asked Scarborough, so why the tea industry?
Right. Well, so I started Fire Pot for the first time about 18 years ago now. I was living in Bozeman, Montana, and I was cooking at a tea house called the Tibetan Trader, and that is where I developed the recipe for Fire Pot Chai. I was 26 years old at the time, and my life up until then had been really directed by a love for sustainable agriculture and a lifelong desire to own land and to have and live on an organic farm one day. I had been working in sustainable ag throughout my 20s at university in Connecticut and then also in California and in Montana. And I was really just turned on by the idea of, you know, bringing more sustainable living and sustainable agriculture to the masses and learning about what that meant. I had taken part in the agroecology program at the University of California in Santa Cruz when I was 25, and that's where I started to become aware of sustainable agriculture more from a global perspective. So I started thinking beyond organic farming and sustainable living on a local scale and started to shift my focus to international sustainable agriculture and to the organic farming of commodity crops like coffee and tea and cocoa. And I began to learn about how these agricultural systems were rooted in poverty and trafficking, disempowerment, pesticide use. I started to learn then about systems like fair trade and organizations like Rainforest Alliance that were using trade to try to alleviate all of these issues. So it was right after my course in agroecology at UCSD that I found myself at the tea house in Montana, and I began experimenting with chai recipes. I was really on a bit of a sabbatical from this agroecology work that I had been so immersed in, and that is where I developed a recipe for Fire Pot Chai, and after that it was like magic. Everything just sort of came together and fell in place, and my love for agroecology, for travel, for making a difference in the world, all came together through this chai recipe that I'd created, and things began unfolding in the most serendipitous and sort of divine way. I started blending, packing, and selling the chai. I got the domain fairtradeteas.com, which I thought definitely would never have been available at that time. And then friends just started showing up and made labels for me. Another friend built a website. Different friends helped with sales. And all of a sudden, I had a business running. I really didn't know what I was doing. I had no business experience, really. Definitely had never gone to business school. I was just riding on a lot of passion and a big dream. At the time, I had a really strong sense of knowing that this was my path. Everything felt really illuminated, and all of the things that I loved were brought together. And something about Firepot at the time, it just felt really right. It felt like a very clear path. And the brand, the company has always been, throughout the last 18 years, really magnetic like that. From the beginning, it was all about being a force of good. It was about connecting women, connecting tea lovers with tea growers to improve the lives of both. And it always just was there to make a positive difference in the world. And I think that people really resonate with that. The mission today is the same that it ever was. And, you know, since I started Firepot and was running it, my course, my personal path with tea began to take off. Different opportunities landed in my lap when I was 27. Firepot and I moved to Alaska, where I was living off the grid with an ex-boyfriend. And I would ski to my car in the winter, which was plugged in at the end of the dirt road where we lived. And I would drive to the library, where I would get on the computer because I didn't have, you know, that was before the days of the smartphone, really, or even the cell phone. I would go in and check internet orders. I would go to the kitchen, the commercial kitchen that I was renting, pack tea, drive to the Talkeetna, Alaska post office, and ship chai from Oregon to California to Montana. I even had accounts as far away as Sweden. So that was sort of the next step in Firepot. And then one day when I was working at the Alaska Mountaineering School, I got an email from an old friend who was living in New Zealand, and he had learned about what I was doing. And he had some business partners that had come together to, you know, they had all the different pieces to run a business. They just didn't really have an idea for a business. So he and his partners were interested in bringing me to New Zealand to tell them a little bit more about what I was doing, and to start a social enterprise that would pioneer fair trade into the Australasian markets. So after that email, I think it was probably a week, and I was on an airplane to New Zealand for 3 weeks, having meetings with him and his partners about ethical trade and, you know, how we could pioneer that into mainstream markets and give people an ethical alternative to the multinational tea, coffee, and chocolate. And we ended up starting a brand called Scarborough Fair that did just that. So during that time, I spent a lot of the time working. I was traveling around Sri Lanka, Nepal, India, Latin America, and hiking, backpacking, biking through these communities to understand firsthand with my own eyes, and not just reading in books or websites, what ethical trade meant, you know, what these organizations were doing, what the real problems were. I was so curious to find out what the problems were and how we could make a difference. I just had this drive to do that and to really discover the truth behind trade. And then Scarborough Fair continued to run. It's still running today in Australia and New Zealand. But in 2007, I returned back to Nashville and started another tea company that came to me through another line of just serendipitous actions. I kept having these opportunities fall into my lap, one after the other, to start different tea companies. And, you know, again, it's just this path that I've been on with tea has been so clear the whole time for the past 18 years. In 2007, I returned back to Nashville, and then we started a company, a friend of mine and I, called Partners Tea Company, and we ran that. It was a beautiful, fair trade, organic, boutique, more gift line of teas, and we had a really strong mission to give back to women and to empower women. We ended up taking on women investors and really doing everything that we could, both locally and globally, in the communities that we sourced from, to give back and to empower women through these teas. And again, that was just another extension of the original mission of Firepot, even though it was under a completely different brand. But we sold that company to the Republic of Tea in 2011, and then I went on to work as a tea buyer for the Republic of Tea in 2011, about a month after I got married. So I married my husband, Jeff, and I think he felt like he might have gotten bait and switched a little bit, because as soon as we got married, I was on a plane and very rarely home. I traveled all the time with that job. I was discovering new tea origins, working on sustainability initiatives for the Republic of Tea. And about a year and a half later, by some miracle, I managed to get pregnant. And in 2012, was still traveling, even though I was early on pregnant. And I think in the first 3 months of, you know, being pregnant with my oldest son, I had been to Nepal and India and London and San Francisco once or twice, and Japan and Korea, not to mention trips to St. Louis up to the office. So it was a lot of travel. And then my doctor finally grounded me and told me I had to stop traveling and working. So so I took some time off when I had Everett, my first son, and just spent time at home walking my dog and baking, and for the first time just really relaxing and not focusing on tea at all. And he was born right around Christmas in 2012. And it was the next spring, I think it was about March, that I woke up with this surge of energy and excitement, because I, you know, there I was with a 3 or 4 month old baby and no work. And that was a foreign concept to me, because I'd always been driven by this, you know, dream and passion for what I love to do around agriculture and tea. And I knew that it was time to bring Firepot back to life. I'd always, you know, as I did all these other projects in tea, I always knew that one day I would bring Firepot back to life. One day I would build it to its full potential. One day I would, you know, really harness the good energy of Firepot and bring it to the world. And I woke up really excited just one morning, and I thought, oh, it's time. And I got, you know, I got to work and I started back in my kitchen, just product developing. And I found a space on a really popular street in Nashville that I rented out, and I started brewing and bottling the chai. I pretty quickly and easily picked up accounts across Nashville for wholesale distribution of chai, and then outsourced eventually the manufacturing of the chai, so that I was able to go out and pick up more accounts and scale the business. And it all, as it always had with Firepot, just flowed really easily. And then by the time I was pregnant with my second son, Rye, I had already partnered with my current partners in Firepot. And, you know, I was pretty hesitant at first, because, after, you know, I'd already experienced having investors and partners, and I really had a strong sense of wanting to do it by myself and just be a one-woman show. But it made a lot of sense to partner with them. And I think my mantra throughout this whole journey anyway has been, when opportunities have landed in my lap, my first gut is usually, no, I think I'm just going to stay where I am. And then after a period of time, I sort of start to go, well, why not? You know, why wouldn't I partner with them? Or why wouldn't I move to New Zealand? Or, you know, why wouldn't I go back to Nashville and start this company? So that's really been something that's driven me the whole way. And so I ended up taking on my partners, and they've been amazing at helping grow and scale the brand and have taken over daily operations, so that now I'm free to focus on product development. But also the thing I'm more excited about is our mission and our sustainability initiatives.
I'd love to hear about your partnership with, your new partnership with Aquila, this women's university in Rwanda. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's really exciting. Like I said, Firepot's always had a real heart to empower and promote women. And we've always been members of 1% for the Planet, which is a membership organization of businesses that give 1% of sales, not profits, to environmental or social organizations. So Firepot partnered about a year or so, maybe it's been 2 years now, actually, with Aquila Institute. So Aquila Institute is an all-women's university in Rwanda. And it was started in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. So from Rwanda, they are empowering women. They're transforming education globally by preparing their students to find practical solutions to the real issues of our future. So they're really upending education, not only by bringing women forward, but by also focusing on issues like climate change, sustainability, an increased reliance on technology, population growth. So they're bringing a whole new perspective to education, and they're looking at the problems with our current education system and working to fix them. All, you know, and it all started in Rwanda to empower women, and they're on a really exciting growth trajectory as well. They've just opened a second co-ed campus in Hong Kong, and they're fulfilling their mission from that campus as well. So that's called Davis College. So our partnership is that Firepot donates 1% of all of our sales to Aquila, and Rwanda is an important origin to us because it's where we source all of the tea for our chai, and we use Rwandan tea for a lot of the other teas that we sell, like black breakfast teas and other, you know, our Earl Grey has some Rwandan tea in it. We have a tea called Music City Morning that is a Rwandan black tea. So it's a really important origin for us. We love to get involved locally through wellness and yoga events, and then globally in the communities where we work. So Aquila has been amazing at facilitating that for us.
Fantastic. Sarah Scarborough from Firepot Nomadic Teas, thanks so much for being with us. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1578.